Any of the passages you want to read now? We can discuss. Go ahead, John. You're first. We'll just go down the line.
Okay. I'd like to ask about, just read it out loud here. Mm-hmm. It's a long one. It's on 190 and 191.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "There is, however, a ridiculousness we should guard against, talking ingratiatingly about Christianity. I wonder if a man handing another man an extremely sharp, polished, two-edged instrument would hand it over with the air, gestures, and expression of one delivering a bouquet of flowers. Would not this be madness? What does one do then? Convinced of the excellence of the dangerous instrument, one recommends it unreservedly, to be sure, but in such a way that in a certain sense one warns against it. So it is with Christianity. If what is needed is to be done, we should not hesitate to wear of the highest responsibility to preach in Christian sermons, yes, precisely in Christian sermons, against Christianity. For you know full well where disaster strikes these days, namely that by foolish and ingratiating Sunday talk, Christianity has been deceptively transformed into an illusion, and we have been tricked into the fancy that we, just as we are Christians." And he goes on, "Yet if a man thought he was holding a flower in his hand, a flower which he somewhat idly, somewhat thoughtlessly delighted to look at, and then someone truly discerning shouted to him, 'You poor man, don't you realize you are holding a very sharp, polished, two-edged sword?' I wonder if he would not become terrified for a moment."
Who does one of those comments particularly remind you of in our own culture today? We can call it Schulerism.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
That's right on the head for that. And it's, I think, extremely dangerous to start playing those games with God that we're all in just because we parked our car in the church parking lot. And then you get, Jeremiah cries out, "You deceived me and I was deceived." You know it was going to involve all that before it was through. I wrote an article once for our church paper that created a little havoc for my opportunity to get into seminary, because Dr. George Austin was quite furious with it, but I said, "Oh, God tricks us. It makes it something." I mean, the people came out of Egypt thinking it was a picnic, but a generation had to die. It can look much more facile and simple and easy than it is, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's getting at, if you read. At least the preacher ought to warn them. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, our seminary all said there should be frequent sermons on the danger of going to church.
But I still seldom remember.
You say that, you're crazy.
I know, that kind of a Schuller attitude that we got too much of in American Christianity, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's. I remember when Dr. Morris Wheat came to Central Blues and I took him out for lunch. And he paid for it to me, and he also gave me $100 for Holden Village. He was very faithful to him from that time on. But I said, "Moore, you've been preaching a kind of success Christianity which won't go at Central. You've got too many failures." I said, "After all, at least 3,000-4,000 failures that you've got to confront every Sunday. And you can't face that without really allowing the depths of the gospel to come into play." And it was exciting. The last 3 years of his ministry there was really a denial of that whole success Christianity he preached before. That's on the Central when it first came. And it did bring in that whole anguish of the relationship, because, not least, what did it for him? Future shock. Future shock just knocked him right off his chair. And he realized that's the direction our culture is taking. And we're allowing it to happen by this facile kind of lack of real proclamation. It kind of, we're all these wonderful, fine people here today in church. How nice to see you all. And so on, and then my dear brothers and sisters in Christ, and then you preach that way. It's tough. Some of us, I think, are so genial anyway that we kind of have to make sure we aren't fooling them. I know Mary used to say about one of my dear friends in the ministry, it's a tremendous preacher, that when he shakes hands at the door, they all say, "Oh, he didn't really mean it, but he's so nice." Could have been senator from South Dakota without even trying. He just refused to declare for a party. And now his pastor, one of our significant pulpits in Chicago, United Lutheran down there, so do you know. But he's just a beautiful guy who lives with his own tragedy, a very ill wife, right arm that comes down to his elbow, and a birth defect. And he's just so genial and rosy and wonderful. Difficult for people to really, really need it,
Yeah.
And that's what was getting Kierkegaard, this sort of... I'm just reading it now on Jose Anderson, the great fairy story, and he liked him. He wrote to him and said, hoping that he could be my medic for him, hoping he could get him out of this sort of sentimentalizing of the Danish spirit and to where he would confront the need himself. After all, there's a cross at the heart of Christianity. That's not beautiful.
Cross is a little sweet. This is talking during Venus and sense of, you know, if you put a noose around your neck, you know, you'd have what the cross was. In the sense of, something of the sense of the church and the society is, and if you get lost in the art.
Art form.
If you put a noose around your neck, that's what the cross is.
I always take a break.
The cross stands for exactly what the hangings was.
And that doesn't mean you have to kind of make your temperament into something like mine or anything like that, where I walk into a room, people take sides. Johan, my oldest, always sort of feels guilty because everybody likes him. I mean, he's kind of hurt him, you know. So he got tied in with this primitive Christianity group in Minneapolis for a little while, and I said, well, Johan, I always feel that the big concern, this is Kierkegaard's concern, to make first-generation Christians out of second-generation Lutherans. It was really his whole concern. And it's been my whole concern. And you can get derailed on that very easily by picking up some things that are not essential to it. And that's what he was in right then with primitive Christianity and tongues and healing and so on. And you can sort of, you know, go out on that sort of glamour roof to get really what's coming down to still. It's what isn't easy for any of us. Death. So we come alive.
The reason I read that is because I so seldom ever remember hearing anything with that kind of tone at all in a church, and like the big push now being, you know, evangelism. You think if a pastor preached about a noose, how long would he stay there?
Yeah. This the pastors in Seattle discussed this in some depth when Billy Graham was coming, because Orth was on the committee and he'd just come from it. Norman Orth is a very fine pastor up at Richmond Beach. And he said it really was bothering him because this whole sort of use of mass media, this whole positive approach, the absence of what we call a theologia crucis in our theological language, a theology of the cross. Mm-hmm. That, or like Becker puts it, it's always failure. And this is what's difficult for us. I had it in my lectures to the youth leaders of the world in Europe, and when I'd sent my original copy from my lectures to the American youth leaders, they were furious. And Merton Strumman still is. I asked him, were you really mad? Yes, I was mad. I said, I just don't understand you, Merton. And I still don't. What I'd said was this. It's impossible to work with youth without a continual failure complex. How can you work with people and be successful? Is it possible, really? I don't know. I raised the issue over there, and I put it a little differently so they wouldn't be so furious, but at the same time, I don't know how to do it. I don't know of any possibility, because I can't live with myself and say I'm a success. How can I say that I'm successful with people? You always feel the, well, I love Philip's translation of that particular verse, Romans 3:21, we've all fallen short of the beauty of God's plan. And that's where we're at. And that's all Kierkegaard's trying to get through to us in this kind of intensive sort of discipleship that he's presenting, that you can't simply go licky-e-ly, as they say, indifferent in a kind of nice way, you know. Tranquility is the word that Becker uses all the time. The people buy their tranquility at the expense of their soul. I remember the guys in the high school, in college, Tiny Jelstad saying one time, I'd sell my soul for another hello, you know, the fear of being out of step. And it's a real wonderful And I think it's particularly difficult for the youngest of the Christians, those who are new in the faith and the discipleship, for kids in high school, for example, where nobody thinks very much. They're perhaps the only people in high school, because we don't have any communist group in our American scene much, who are really trying to think through the tragedy of our society, the fact that we've all fallen short of the beauty of God plan. That the bigger the idea, usually the smaller the guy that's holding it. And he talks big, but, you know, like the guy said in prison camp, the fellow that had the most idealism, always talking about idealism, had the biggest stash of cans of food under his bed. don't fool anybody, really. And this is his anguish to get through to the level where we really are, so that we come alive, so we really exist. And that's what he's mentioning. He never became a self. He never became a person. He never became an individual. This was a constant sort of echo you heard the other night when I was reading some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, in the Lutheran Church today, is it a problem that, are the ministers preaching to what the people want to hear, or are they preaching to what they want to hear, or both? Or I was home for Christmas and I heard a sermon that went, he was comparing God to a beauty parlor and how people go in and then they come out beautiful, and I kind of was, what?
No. We even go down and take special beauty courses from Schuler. You know,
that's where he's taking them.
Yeah, no,
you know.
Guys, has he? Really?
Yeah.
No, that's what
church
guys do.
Counseling.
Really? Yeah, well, that's what they do. No, that's it. I heard a sermon coming through a blizzard one Sunday morning in Iowa as we're driving up to get to St. Olaf or something. Last year ago. And it's a fellow dear and been one of my own students. And preached a good sermon the next Sunday, which I did write and tell him was excellent. Hang in there on that one. The one the Sunday before, I told him, you might have thought he prayed for the gift of being a phony. Well, they really do, I think. That's what they mean by image making.
And if you don't do that, you will find out what the cross is in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
On the phone. I mean, if you gave a sermon like the Scripture is talking about here, you'll find out what the cross means as a follower of Christ. I was very happy this winter to find out that some people don't like me, because that was something that I really was worried about. I mean, I felt guilty about being a nice guy. You know? What am I doing wrong?
You can't say that. take Maury Lee for a good example. There's nobody more beautiful, more likable that we've had in the ministry. Just plain is a remarkably beautiful guy. And very, very likable. And yet, when he started to preach in this real direction after a future shock, all the people had been his buddies and good friends became his enemies. And when he resigned from Central Lutheran, I had a big fight with the leader of his opposition, who's a classmate of mine from Central High. His son's been out here. This does not have any notion of Christianity at all. Every morning I wake up thinking I shall appear before God with honor. And he's an outstanding lawyer in Twin Cities. I wish Art Wongard, who's in the same church, was still alive, who was our most outstanding lawyer before him in the whole Twin City picture, and who knew the grace of God motivated him and might have gotten through to him. But like Creepy says, I'm certainly a great guy and using law in order to bring you grace, you know. But if anybody who's living in that relationship to himself still has not seen that we're always in error, but we're never in doubt. We've got to act, and we know that God has to be the God of sinners, so we can act. Because otherwise, action becomes impossible, if you really think it through. Because no matter what kind of an act you make, it's a compromise with what ought to be. And the people who don't face that live in this grandeur of their own idealism and so on, and they end up
zombies.
It voices
your opinion with regret from rhetoric, where you get to the point where you know enough about your subject so that when you state your opinion, it will be with regret, because you know that you're in error. Yet you have to act, you have to speak.
We've had a lot of that. For instance, we had what we call Lundensian theology that I learned Swedish to study, because the man who was the leading proponent of it in our seminaries, he was at a seminary since joined with the Chicago one, the Augustana one down in Rock Island, and he said that the very fact that anyone goes to church is prima facie evidence that he's already become a Christian, and it cannot be doubted. Well, what that means is that everybody else was to carry a cross except the pastor. So, because a layman was real at all, he's going to be confronting the kind of sneers and laughter and so on at his job, or teacher, you can't escape it wherever they are, but only the pastor. He's just surrounded by fine Christian people all going to church. You know, and it's anything but true. So it made me so mad, I learned Swedish. And I found out Lundensian theology does not wind up that way. But it is true. The other side is true, is that we judge no one outside the church. We judge those who are within. We judge ourselves. And because our hope is that we can be to the world what Christ is to us. And that they then can walk over us to him, you know. This is our concern, is that no one be left out. We certainly don't want the church being in weak or ghetto. But it remains your mission field, as honestly as you put it so well. And every parish is a mission. I used to tell my congregations all that I've ever had. Boy, I'm glad there are a lot of unconverted people here today. It is where you ought to be. I don't care what brought you here, your girlfriend, your business. I will care what keeps you coming. But I don't think it's in any of us to start off just because we're such swell guys and this is what I want. Jesus appeals to me. That's the way of life I want, and so on. Who are we fooling? Because we do have this self-esteem that Becker always talks about as our prime motive. We want to be well thought of. I remember how uptight I was when I was not a Christian about initiating the friendship, even as if I should start something and then the other not meet me halfway, so scared lest I might go 60% of the way, making sure it's exactly 50, you know. And that's why these guys don't ever get married, some of them too, because, you know, you've got to take a risk then. Don't even ask for dates. I used to stand at the telephone and say, open, ask for dates. The girls are all these big athletes. Guys are scared death that they get turned down. But they didn't mind if they get turned down through me. That's like I had married my male before I did. Well, it's very unpleasant. You can always say, I think if this applies, you ought to read it or you can throw it away. But, you know, we just don't want to face up to ourselves.
When you said always in error, never in doubt, is that speaking to sin boldly?
Yes, exactly.
That's what it means?
Exactly. You take your decision complexes. Here's a cute one. Here's a very capable organist. And he's been invited to be the professor of organ at Wittenberg College. But he's also spent several years learning French and speaking it well, so he's assistant to our French bishop of our Lutheran church in Paris. And besides that, he has a little English congregation there for us in Paris. And he brought him to the Falls, Minnesota with me. And he's really caught between these, what should I do? And Warren Quanbeck comes through. And on his way down to Rome for some of those meetings of Vatican Council, he has dinner with him. And he just tells him, well, just make up your mind right now that whichever decision you make, you're wrong. You're still a sinner. What I usually do with my decisions, I've just done John this, and what I've done, I've kept it in a notebook, so if I haven't lost them all, every time I make a decision, I try to say, plus and minus for the new man, plus and minus for the old Adam, you know, and see where you're at. But you never come out. Like I say, you leave for China on the train from the Union Depot in Minneapolis, and you feel like practically all your friends and relatives died at once, and by the time the next relatives are meeting me in Wilmar, I'm telling them, well, you know, I wonder, am I a missionary? For, you know, the love of the gospel and the Chinese, or because I'd like to travel. I'm already enjoying the trip, you know. And you never escape that side of it. I don't see how we can. I mean, we always have a double motive. We're good people. And if you see anybody who isn't, you really met a good actor, as Kierkegaard says. And then you've met a really good actor. That's what worried him about the Danish bishop, that he liked so much, that was a good actor. So this is where he presses the whole of our time, because he's being read so much, and because he's very much in, and because people see the fundamental problem of description of our human scene, he's right, and that is that it is boredom, it's emptiness, it's meaninglessness, and he's speaking to this for modern man. That's why people are reading him like crazy, because he's shown these three different ways in which are the sort of overarching ways in which different people try to evade and escape that. And he's doing it sympathetically. He himself has been caught in the ways himself. But he's doing it at the same time with a kind of incisiveness that they can't escape. As his kind of approach does reach these people who are caught in their own thinking between what they would like people to think they are and what they know they are, and you can start to speak to them. But I think finally that theology itself, as theology, most of Kierkegaard is not theology, it's philosophy. Theology is what you're getting in works of love. That theology deals with those who are in the faith and know the Lord to clarify for them their idolatries so that they can gain mastery over them and not live in them. But the The world is won not by theology, but by witness. So when I write theology now, I have to write it for somebody. So I'll be writing for the village community. I mean, I've got to address somebody. You've got to have an audience. Mm-hmm. Barth's audience was the Lutheran Christian for the German. He did not write for the Calvinist, which was his own background. And that's why he's the best critic we've had. And he drew on Kierkegaard tremendously in his earlier writings when he was most excited to do this stuff. Like what he did, he tried to make Kierkegaard contemporary to the German scene in the 30s.
Carol isn't, I was able to have a phrase this, is this kind of question that always lives and abides in me with Kierkegaard. Isn't his primary concern simply in calling the person to the cross? He doesn't seem to speak as much in his writings about the going out from the cross.
Now, I think this is the way that he's fundamentally heard. Now, this is not true for Works of Love, but it's true up until he wrote that.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true for everything he did up until he wrote this.
Yeah, I
want to. Now, and generally speaking, unfortunately, as far as the way in which Christianity gets heard in our Scandinavian Lutheran countries, is your people say, well, it shows us what. It shows us what we're to give up, but doesn't show us what we're to take on. it leaves us short as to what do you become in following Christ. But his I think the way most people see Kierkegaard now is that his whole life is given to this becoming a Christian, and all of life is becoming a Christian too. So that side of it is true for you. You're always in that state of becoming, and that grasps also a fundamental note all the way through with the Apostle Paul. I don't pretend I've laid hold of, but yet, but I lay, I press on, forgetting what's behind to what's
that's
before.
That's where we then say is that, sure, I'm not that, but Christ is my Christianity for me.
Yeah, that's right. You come to that point, that frees you from that constant digging at your spiritual belly button. Yeah, and allows you to find your neighbor. Singoli, like you said, again, in the sense that you enter into the anguish of the actual human situation. Kierkegaard does one beautiful thing for any Christian that reads him. You don't get into this trite, awful kind of absenteeism from the human scene of, I settled that long ago. Christ settles everything, He keeps you where the pain is. He keeps you in the human hurt.
Yeah.
And he keeps you sharing the human hurt. Like our Lord says, where I am, there will my servants be. And Jesus is not apart from this anxiety of the human situation. And that's why Kierkegaard really, put your nose into it. And you can't escape into a nice little cultic kind of coziness apart from it. That's where he's so great. Now, that's where seminaries have resented him. Guys at the seminaries, when I was at, they wouldn't be. He doesn't let you keep your assurance. Thou will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee. And he didn't have it, this sort of thing. This is what I'd hear from my fellow students when I was a student at the seminary. And so they had settled for a concept of tranquility again, really. They were in possession of the truth, and they'd say that. We've got the truth. Now, that's to me, it's a horror. The truth as us, that's another thing. But when you've arrived, and you're in, and now you can be others with it, it's not the way the New Testament relates. Us. In fact, Jesus himself makes it very specific, and he holds to it all the way through. I did not come for the well, but for the sick. I didn't come for the righteous, but for the sinner. And so if you've gotten beyond being a sinner, and beyond being sick, as Luther puts it very, very simply, Christ dwells only in sinners. So now you have a paper Christ, not the real one. And people like that find that themselves very able to live very easily with Solomon's Christ on their door, on their walls, and with a kind of sentimental mentality of a religion, not a relationship. In the relationship, there's always that sense of identity in him with those with whom he's identifying himself. And in that sense, I think Temple was right. Archbishop Temple addressed a group of students when I just finished the college, and Mary went down for it. She was down there from the university, and he said, Christianity, the church, he said, the church is the only institution that exists for those who are not in it. That's a good way to put it. The church is the only institution that exists for those who are not in it. And you're always seeing the anguish of those on the outside, aren't you? And certainly if Debs can't have any peace, and that's Eugene Debs, who headed the Communist Party in World War II, spent his time in jail, he says, as long as anybody's in prison, I'm there. As long as there's somebody that's hurting, I am. And I think that that's what the prayer says. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on planet Earth. See? And that's an anguish cry. It isn't just a mumbly jumble. You're living in that constant agony of the kingdom when you're in the law. And that's why Jesus says, and I use that phrase for the seminary guys, why they ought to learn Greek. Agonesis, that is the word, it's present imperative, meaning something with which you're never through. Keep on anguishing if you want to enter the kingdom. Keep on striving to enter the kingdom. Many will try and will fail. See, you're never outside of that agonesis thing. See, a continual agony of the kingdom. And that's what's upsetting for a lot of people as they're studying Kierkegaard, because it's like Becker says about him too. You're always on the edge of blowing your brains. Why don't you blow your brains? Because you're being kept. Because as Jesus says, my burden is easy, my yoke is light, because it's his. It's the privilege you have of sharing his anguish over the earth instead of living in the emptiness of your boredom. Just the privilege. And so you become alive, you're a person. And then you're permitted to be the person you are, because you're no longer defensive by being who you are, and you can't be put down. And so there's something vital and new that's coming through you into our human situation. And that's true for all who are in him. With a kind of laughter at yourself, that's delightful. Last time when I preached in Juneau, you know, it was really fun, because you could see that gleam of humor in the eyes of the members. They weren't taking themselves seriously, they were taking God seriously. And they knew that the old self-deception would still keep on going, you know. Marvelous, really, what happens under this. But you do have that delightful kind of a, savoir faire, whatever you want to call it, poise of a person who is at ease because he's forgiven, and he can relate to the next person in the same forgiveness. He doesn't come uptight about himself and judgmental towards the other. Doesn't mean you lose your brains. Jesus says right after, he says, judge not, you be not judged. He says, don't throw your pearls before swine. You're not going to waste your lives on people who have no ears to hear. He says, shake off the dust from your shoes and go to another city. But you don't have to continue where there's no hearing either. And this has to be your own judgment. And he sins in whichever way you choose, you're wrong. You know? I mean, I had a chance to go to the University of Chicago and be with so-called people that were troubled and tormented, and not live with our Norwegian Lutherans, who only torment and trouble is that they hadn't got a big enough hunk of America yet. And they've gotten it since pretty well, since 1950. But you have to make a few decisions for me before you go on in the mission. Some others, other some there? No, that's good. A very good starting conversation here. What we're getting at really is what he defines, Kierkegaard defines, is in terms of the difference between religion A and religion B. Religion A, which is still essentially self-serving, and religion B, in which there is a death, so Christ comes alive. Religion A, in which you're still using God, and religion B, in which you're letting God use you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you
have
to be continually striving and involved in the hurt of the world, then what kind of peace is
this
kind of peace?
Now, this is the peace of Christ himself that's present in that hurt. Remember, I suppose the best little description for that biblically is John 15. I am the vine, you are the branches. My Father is a husbandman. Every branch that beareth fruit, he prunes and may bring forth more fruit. The pruning hurt, but it's only bearing more fruit. And then he goes on. Remember, he carries you through that whole thing. Abide in me, let me abide in you, continue my love. This is my Father's will, you bear much fruit, so prove to be my disciples. And then finally he says, all these things I have spoken unto you, that my joy may be in you and your joy be full. You're real. You're real. Because you are sharing his hurt, who is the one who is in charge. And you're part of his hurting. And it's the permission that he gives you to to love, really. It's the same prison camp that you, pain comes to everybody, but suffering only those who love. You don't have to suffer. Just don't love, because you'll never be alive either. And that's where the presence of Christ himself. And he pulls you off from dramatizing your hurting. You don't dramatize that. Your relationship as it is with Kirkhorst so beautifully is in the continual psalm of being God's poem yourself for the world. But out of the hurt comes something that's laughter over yourself and real for the world, in which you're not trying to disciple people, but only be myletic for them, to a midwife to them, for the person that they really are. And you don't feel all uptight about that relationship. You know there's no such thing as anything like 100%, like success, but at the same time there is, you are a witness. And it's he who lives who's carrying that through, and he doesn't let it fall to the ground without finding some good soil for it. That should show you all. But still there is, there's like the psalm, puts that they that go forth weeping bearing precious seed shall doubtless return rejoicing bearing their sheaves with them. See, two things together. And it's always those two things go together. That's why, I suppose, with our own particular Lutheran church, it's a suspicion about the songs that are only in the major key, that are la-da-di-da-da, you know. I got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart, you know. And then there's much more of an identity where you have the two, where you've got the pain and the joy together, you know. And that's what our chorales have, isn't it? That's the way they get through those. Thou but suffer God to guide thee, and trust in him in all thy ways, you know. He'll give thee joy, whatever betide thee, and bear thee through thee, O day. Who trusts in God's unchanging love, builds on the rock that not can move. But that went right along, and leave it out of ready Henry. It went on, all are like before the highest, he raiseth up, and he makes low, he raiseth thee up, though poor thou liest, within the rich man poor and low. Two wonders still by him are wrought, who raiseth up and brings to naught. And you're in that continuous revolution of God who does make new and who renews the earth. And so you don't give up. You don't live on this sad sack side. There isn't a single one of the heroic figures in Christendom that were sad sack. They had their bad moments. But like Calvin says, the church has often looked dead before, but God has given them a new resurrection. And you're living for the next resurrection. Even times of the drop and they, what do they speak, the dark night of the soul, you know, the fourth call, and then those times come. But you're still living from God's hand, and you take your life from his hand. And you know, even in the sense of his distance, that he's most near. In fact, one of my sermons here at the village, I called him, his distance is his dearness. Because out of that very awareness of his wonder and his holiness comes also how good and how patient he is with you. One of the psalms we've memorized now in Lent, in Psalm 25, and one of the verses goes, good and upright is the Lord, therefore will he teach sinners in the way. You'd say, therefore will he hold his nose? You say, no. just the other one. Good and upright, therefore will he teach sinners. That's the wonder, I say that's the essential mystery subjectively described of Christianity, isn't it? I've always found the kids in the youth movement very quickly caught this when you'd say, any of you bored? You know, that they aren't. But your friends who don't know them are bored. Well, why don't you go along with your friends? They're not hurting, but they're bored. So the constant place to which I say our own inward life comes back to, like the North Star, is either to the emptiness and boredom of those who don't know Christ, or to sharing his pain over the world for those of us who do. But in that sharing his pain is our joy fulfilled, because it's his. Because he permits us not to live in our emptiness, but to permit our lives even to count, which is, you know, part of his going. Like that glorious essay called Inutility by Jacques Ellul, that some of you read in Politics of God and Politics of Man. The wonderful thing is it's in God's hand. You don't have to sit around on Monday morning and wonder how much a ticket costs to get out of town, you know, to never see the place again because it seems you're that ineffectual. But you hang in there. And finally, some great things can happen. Remember when One of my uncles came through my first parish. I'm just saying, I've been here 2 years and far as I'm concerned, I'm still concerned much. He says, no, you aren't. He says, you're holding the kernels over the fire, and when one starts to pop, you'll be surprised how many more begin to, which is just what happened. But you don't give up. You can't give up. You endure with joy.
The peace sounds like, I mean, contrast almost passive.
It can be that way. But you see, the word for peace, really, that I oftentimes say, that when Jesus says, my peace I give unto you, not as the world gives, give I unto you, it's a kingdom morah that keeps you in the struggle, that keeps you in the agon, with all the poison morale of you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and appointed you. See? That crazy story I tell, like being in the same choir when I went to see Chris Johnson, and he asked me to come see him, and I thought I was going to be, kicked off because I really didn't belong there, and his son didn't either, so the question was whether Paul or I were the 63rd member of the choir. I think they had put a couple extra on just to put us on, frankly. And when I came into where he was at the piano, he looked at me and said, Hinderly, who chose you for my choir? I said, you did. Don't forget it. Goodbye. And when you feel like you don't belong, that's what the Lord tells you, isn't it? Isolate it. You're mine. But Christy would be tough on me. I mean, I can remember in Milwaukee, we were having an afternoon concert too, and that day a lot of cute high school girls and good-looking girls were sitting in the front seat, you know, and my eyes wandered from Christy. He just raised at me like that, and I got red, and then he laughed right on. Well, that's what our Lord does with us. Keep your eyes. He kisses his son as to be angry. But he can also smile over why we wander away, too. But this is the very presence of Christ himself. That's the pilgrimage presence. One of the fine preachers of our time, the greatest king in the world, is one of his great sermons, one of the great kings of our century, another one of the greatest need of the world. But he has the vision of the Christian peace is like a bird singing by a tumult of the waterfall. The tumult of the waterfall and the roaring are there, but there's also a bird singing in the middle of it. I can't even think of his name. He's a Scotsman. Scotsman, I get it mixed up. I know Robertson and Robinson and Disney, the greatest thing in the world. Beautiful. On 1 Corinthians 13, there was a sermon preached to missionaries, actually. It's a sermon that got me thinking about Christianity. And then I thought, well, he said somebody tried, he lived with this particular chapter, love suffers long, it's kind, love ends not, love long, it's not itself. And so he lived with it for a month, it changed his life. So I thought, well, I better live with it. And I lived with it for a year and a half, and after a year and a half, I still fight when everybody came along. All these rich bastards that used to call them at St. College that could play golf and have money to go out on dates and stuff. I hated them, you know. I was the corresponding secretary for our social club. Put them down and get them to go to work. One of the last things I did was to tangle one of his father owned a men's clothing store in Austin, Minnesota. So he was always dressed to perfection, you know. As I recall, I did have one suit, the same suit, all the way through college that I bought for $16 off a Jewish friend of mine by the name of Nate. And I actually got it both price from my phone. But I started to fight with him on the third floor of the old Edible Hall and ended up in the basement. We rolled down all the stairs and I was hating him all the way. And then I'd be turning that in that night to go through Love Suffers Long in this time. Greatest thing in the world. That's the title. You can get it in any bookstore, by the way. You have to get it in a religious bookstore. I'm sorry, I don't remember right off now. Too sleepy. Some more good questions now. Go around. Those are very excellent. They're right on for Pierre Gore's point. See, the wonderful thing is this essential word that has reached us and that continually reaches us anew and creates anew this. Life of praise within which God dwells is that there is nothing in my hands I bring simply to that cross I claim. That it is what God continually gives. And he doesn't weary of me when I've wearied of myself. Good question. I think all that's necessary for us in terms of the witness is simply that there's a concern. If the other know the Lord who has made himself known to me, and that he lives just as really in his love and desire for that person does for me. So then one way or another we allow that to be known. Sometimes it's done under, well, almost with a sense of anger, but it gets through. They finally hear, even in the anger, that we love them. Oh, you're going to waste your life on nothing. Why don't you let Christ come in? Gee, you're not being miserable all your life, you know? A dozen different ways of witnessing. Everyone has his own, even. But you do know that Jesus lives, and it's only necessary to introduce him. Sometimes you do, like I did with Mary. Mary was president of the Youth League at St. Olaf, and she was just 20, and I wrote her a note saying, well, 20 years old, it's time to quit playing with God and things. And then Fritz came back with her North this year. Now Fritz came back with her for after Christmas vacation. They drove back together in the car, and he said, you know, witches quit praying for you. She always thought she had me, you know. And that kind of helped. I'd still been praying for him, and I thought I had something to do with it, but I didn't. I really quit. I just thought she'd always be just such a personality that she'd never, ever face up to her own bank. She'd get by on her personality. So I'd written her that kind of, no, for her 20th. She had her birthday on the 29th, and mine on the 25th, so I always wrote a little note on her birthday. I'd already had my date, but I'd arranged when I was a freshman to have a date when I was a senior. The way I got that was... I was told all the back of mine, but don't forget, I'm going to marry you. It made her curious, because they didn't have to tell her. Lots of different ways to witness. I think maybe the most effect that I had on my particular generation, you know, is that it was nothing in the way of finances anyway. It always broke, but nothing. And but I was still having more fun than anything. You know, just because you're so alive, it's just because you're so alive, because it's exciting.
But so often when people have witnessed to me, it's just
made me
sick.
Well, that kind of a... You know, that's what I would say, that that's what I felt about Christianity so much. I ran in the North Street. I mean, Chris was the first man I knew that was Christian. And it was true for my uncle, the same age I was. He was a senior, and I was a freshman. And my cousin, who was my roommate, all three of us just simply were one stuff. But here's a guy who claims Christianity, and he's a real man. Not some sort of a... fraud on the human race. And I still had that after I was converted. I couldn't stand the prayer meetings, I mean, I got rid of them when I came into the president's council. I got rid of those prayer meetings in Flexi Bowles. He was very wise. He said, Henry, you get as old as I am, you say, better a poor prayer meeting than no prayer meeting. These guys that practically top each other on the circle, and I just thought, they don't even listen to each other when they pray. You might think it's like vain repetition. But it's easy to make aesthetic judgments on each other that are all wrong, and that's one of the things I think that I did sample very well. I mean, people got the idea if somebody wasn't scintillating and brilliant and so on, I would have nothing to do with them. And that's what you can do with this kind of put down, too. And you make other tender people feel inferior. And it almost cost me my mind at this seminary. Looking in the mirror and I'd comb my hair and so on, I just could hardly stand that. I saw Mama's little boy going in the ministry, and I just prayed, Lord, you know, show me where I'm at, so I can be like Dostoevsky's character, where you really swim in the depths and you know something of what men are like. And all the Lord gave me was a little glimpse of what I've done to my kid sis, and giving her an inferiority complex by all, you know, rapping on her and yelling at her. And it just, Jesus, that almost made me go insane. When I could see some of the things I'd done to others by my kind of morality. I think some of that, but we suffer for our sins. I've been willing to hold back a few clever sayings now, and I wouldn't have had to be at Holden Village. But as everybody says, my problem is that everybody's quoting me correctly. You know, you say some of those things about some people or some situations, and they get repeated off your past. It doesn't make you friends. But it's true that I don't think it's possible in any sense to live in the scripture and be dull or trite or boring. Well, you simply can't. You can't for yourself or for others. Life is just too real. And without you being aware of it, you cross at people all the time. One of the illustrations I use from back in those days, working at the California box at Christmas, so I had a chance to get there a few days early. And right after the Christmas concert with the Santa Choir, I'd go right up through the night with somebody and start work before the Santa class is over. We got 65 cents an hour, which let us get a chance to earn it. Around $80, $90 during Christmas, which in those days was an awful lot of money. 65 cents an hour was, well, St. Louis paid 19, and you get 35 from most jobs, and grown men with families are working for 35 cents an hour. You got 65 in Christmas. And I was, it was long days, 16 hours, stand there, throw on the polymer, you throw, and I was just thinking, well, even some of those postcards might be obscene and so on, but some of them were fresh, some of them were Christian witness. All of them were bringing friends together at least once a year, from Minnesota to California. And I thought, gee, what a deal, get paid 65 cents an hour and be able to get weary, helping to unite friends as you do a job. And I said out loud, without even thinking, I didn't know I'd said aloud. I was sort of half asleep and looked like that. And I said, boy, we sure got it good, better than we deserve. And the guy next to me said, what do you mean we got it good, better than we deserve? We got it coming and lots more. No, he was curious about it. And I looked and I saw he had a nose of Abraham, but not his face. He was out just to, take what he could. And he had more coming, actually, no matter what he got. And you're going to be an offense to people. You can't help it. The very fact that you want to live simply is an offense enough. I found this out for a lot of young married couples in our time. Now, during the 60s, you got a lot of support. But I got out of the ministry at 1954. I've been in the parish since. And from World War II on, there were plenty of Christians wanting to live the way a lot of kids were living in the 60s and the 70s. And their parents are always here. Living without any furniture and sitting on the floor. Why don't you have a car riding on bikes? Everybody thinks you're some kind of nut, But this is the way I want to live. Like Mrs. Turnier told Paul Turnier when he got great and took her out there on their anniversary. She ordered something just that cost only 5 francs. And said, why you order something that only cost 5 francs? And she said, that's what I wanted. And he thought, here he was, creating guilt, and he wanted to create a time for rejoicing. But those things will happen without even trying. I look at this one word, and the Greeks got it from me in the fall a little bit. But I wasn't around here much last fall when we did get started, so some things I usually really didn't get. But I always pick up one of those words that our Lord uses, which is a ergon. The alpha before any word is the alpha privative. It takes away what's in the word. Ergon, you know that from your physics, working. A non-working. Every non-working word out of our mouth we're going to be judged for. And as I say, it isn't that we're uptight about being efficient or saying that we're all saying something sharp and scintillating and so on, but it does mean that the words that we were not thinking of as purposive or a witness or anything else, those are the words that get through. And people will tell you years later, I'll never forget when you said such and such, and you don't remember even their speech. It's just a spillover out of what Jesus says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And that's the witness. Overbrim and overflow of your own heart, you would know. Spirit born to bless, living in its own success. I just shifted that a little bit, and the widow of Mrs. Lawrence Binion gave me permission to change the poem. I wrote and asked her that. She said, no, I said, Lawrence would like that change himself. Lives within his own success instead of its own.
Can you say that?
Overbrim and overflow, if your own heart you would know, for the Spirit born to bless lives within his own success. Meaning it's the overflow of Christ, out of which you are. Uses one of my little books. She's quite delighted. She wanted to get the book. He was the curator of the Oriental section of the British Museum. And when he'd never seen these places, he was so in awe about them. And he wanted to see that huge, big mausoleum of dull brick. And it doesn't seem like so much. You think of a poor guy going to work and working there all the time. What a sense of mission he must have had. More of your particular questions now from any of the sections that are giving you trouble, to share them. Okay. Can you see how over and over what he is repeating, just like Luther in Galatians, with repetition is a mother of learning, they can't hear it enough. And what he's saying over and over again is that it's the living Christ who creates the reality of the other person in their own mystery and uniqueness. That you can't manipulate them, you can't use them, you can't run over them, you can't run past them as if they weren't there. That he's continually creating the neighbor. That this is what it's all about. What we call existential psychology now, of which Becker is one, and Valmy another, and so on, or what you call existential ethics, which Boltman and some of the others have been in, all stress this note from Kierkegaard strongly. That the moment, the place, is the person that's now confronting. And that person, Christ himself, is reaching through to you. And so there is that continuous awareness of his living presence in, as he makes the other a neighbor, and not just an other. And never an object, but always a subject. So that you do, as another one of our contemporary thinkers has put it, you always find your I in the thou of the other. You come to your own awareness of who you are in, with, and under each other. As Bailey says, in our knowledge of God, even of God himself, we come to the knowledge of him in, with, and under each other. And this is the big point that Kierkegaard is making all the way through the Works of Love. So there's an actualization of Jesus' own presence in the concreteness of this particular person and occasion. And it took Kierkegaard a while to get to it. He realized that he had abstracted in his own writings, and either or and so on. And that the all-important moment is this one. And Ibsen picks that up from him in the plays that he wrote out of his inspiration from Kierkegaard, Brand and Enemy of the People and Peer Gynt. And all of those you have echoes from Kierkegaard in those particular plays. That very much alive to Lefebvre. And in fact, the function that Kierkegaard is seeing himself as sort of opening people up to whom they are and making them restless about their non-person, their non-being, so that they are really caught in enough to become human and seek for their own reality. The modern stage has tried to do this. A lot of the drama of our times is what we Lutherans call a second function of the law to drive men to Christ. It doesn't preach, because no drama is any good if it preaches, but it does reflect for your act, like Death of a Salesman, for example. I killed time, threw yourself at the quicker. He never knew who he was, if the son said it was dad. And again and again, this is our contemporary scene. It's difficult for the sermon to do this, let's admit. But the preacher's got a tough task, and if you're in this place, you realize it. I don't talk about those that just fell out to Schulerism or something. But even when all is concerned, you are not given much more than 20 minutes. And if in 20 minutes you can suddenly raise the dead, make a person aware that a voice has been missing, it's marvelous, without hurting those also present who are already in relationship to Christ and who need to be fed some warm bread and not just given a stone either, you know. And so you've got to decide where does your ministry, where do you minister? And I would say for me, and I have been strongly criticized by this, even letters to my board about it, that I do not preach the law. And I say, no, this is true. If they are talking about a certain Lutheran concept of brutalizing people with beating them down with the law. I certainly don't. I don't think it's effective, and I don't think it's even Jesus' way of doing things. I am there, as he says, to feed my sheep, nourish my growing. And so on. I'm there to take care of his flock, and not to make them go out on the defensive and feeling guilty. I'm there not to impose guilt, but to lift it. When I do that, however, when I preach the gospel, the intensity with which God has given me to preach it out of that kind of an anguish over against my many gainsayers, because those who are against me are more numerous than those who are for me. I would never be here. I'd be at the seminary, frankly. The other side of that is the very intensity of the gospel makes those who are not with it know that they are not with it. They have no such hunger. They have no thirst. Jesus says, blessed are the hunger and thirst, you see, and they have none. They're just there. And for them, the whole thing is even kind of meaningless. So what? Like Heine says on his deathbed, and they ask, did God forgive him? Of course, that's his business. You know. But they can't do that with the kind of intensity with which the gospel comes, because it's too meaningful. And when you say good news, your dad, for example, these people are really puzzled. I mean, they're just thrown completely by a little statement like that, you know. And this is, you find your own ways. I'm using John's here, but we all find, when I say that there's been only one Krishna on the earth, we put him on the cross, I'm directly quoting Nietzsche, incidentally, at this moment. That moment, I'm not in the next moment, this next is mine. But that he's my Christianity. The reason why I know I'm saved is because I know I'm not a Christian. If I thought I were one, I'd be as uncertain as everybody else that thinks they are one. But I know I'm not one, that there's only been one, and he's my Christianity. Then you're saying it with a kind of intensity that shocks, you see. And it alerts, hopefully, a few people who have no hunger and thirst to realize, boy, there's something great here that I'm not in on. See? And hopefully they might even be just tipped over enough to where they start to seek it. And he's not far from any one of us, as Paul puts it, all you have to do is cry help and he's there.
That can, you know, it's interesting because you say don't preach law, and yet when you have, you're confessional, you know.
Yeah.
And you're saying something like that, you are, you know, the point of the law, you're getting across perfectly. But there's a problem because a lot of people believe that what you're saying is true about yourself and not about them, right?
Yeah. They say that's because he's crazy.
Yeah.
He is a sinner. He really needs to preach that way.
The real problem with confessional styles is that's the way I think somebody that is, you know, really hurting gets taken by the, you know, confessional person.
Well, it's always possible to opt out and say you're not even in the game. You're just an audience, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. I'm just looking on this one. He's a guy's got all those conflicts. I don't have any. I had a good bringing up.
Yeah.
I've never been in any trouble. And that's where Kierkegaard says, I only ask you to take one commandment, make your choice. Then see if you really keep that. And he's confident that it'll be driven to the cross. Because he knows himself. And it's true.